Thanks very much. I'm really pleased to introduce Chris Kondratieff, who will be talking about a noble experiment that didn't quite work out, WebVan. You may remember when Neal Stephenson wrote Snow Crash, he talked about he visualized the United States where we were no longer good at anything besides entertainment and delivering pizza in under 30 minutes. And WebVan was kind of like that. It could deliver hard frozen ice cream to you in its markets in a 30-minute window. So it was very interesting to me when these trucks started proliferating around New York and San Francisco, which is where I hang out. Let me say a few words about Chris, who spent most of his career moving stuff around and who's always been interested in toys with wheels, as far as I could tell. But first, I met Chris when he was working for Mark Weiser on Ubiquitous Computing at Xerox PARC. And Ubiquitous Computing, as Mark liked to say, was upwardly compatible with reality. He tried to tried to fit in with reality, but loosely. Let's see. Chris has worked at a bunch of other places, of course, besides PARC at SGI and DEC and some startups. And one thing that's interesting about him is he is one of the only three authors who have greater than one paper in an issue of the sitcom Computer Communications Review, which got the ACM Test of Time Award. He's a co-author with Jeff Mogul of two papers, and Len Kleinrock is an author of more than one of the papers in that issue also. So that makes him slightly unusual. Another thing unusual about Chris is he may be the only person in this room who is of ordinary means and owns a Ferrari, which I have never ridden in.
Oh, we'll arrange that.
So, Chris Kondratieff.
Thanks. It's why I read Snow Crash for the first time about the time that I was doing this work, and it both terrified me and thrilled me to see that other people were thinking about this stuff. We never got it quite with the... We didn't have helicopters going around when there was a late delivery, so it was better than that. So I'd like to take you back to a simpler time, a happier time, a time when money flowed easily, when 28-8 modems were everywhere, when 500 megahertz servers were fast, when sock puppets were corporate mascots, when companies that didn't have profits, maybe not even a product, had market caps that were bigger than Procter & Gamble, and they spent millions of dollars running commercials like this.
Article 1. You have the right to remain where you are. You have the right to a weekend, the right to avoid parking lots, the right to spend more time with your family. You have the right to come home from work and find something good waiting for you in the fridge. The right to impeccable produce, well-marbled beef, fish and poultry of the highest integrity, and the right to receive them at everyday grocery store prices. You have the right to be in your house when a delivery is made, the right to open your front door and be met by a friendly face, and the right to have someone else unpack your groceries. You have the right to the good stuff. Brought to you by WebVan.
So my job was to choreograph the trucks, but not for that commercial. We sometimes had two trucks in the same neighborhood, but that was because of the customers. And I'll talk about that a little bit because it was really a problem for us. I realize that there are at least four stories in this slide deck, and I'm going to try and tell you one of them. Four stories are about the distribution center. I'm not going to talk about that too much. About the delivery system, which I hope to talk about. About the wretched excess of the dot-com era, which I'm really not going to talk about. I'll talk about it if you want me to, but that's not the point. And the business model in general, and I'll get into that a little bit, but it's really hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about in a short period of time because there's so many things that it did. But I want to give you a brief timeline. 1996, Louis Borders was looking for something to do. He started this company called Intelligent Systems for Retail. The web was starting to be hot, and he thought that there was some way to combine physical stores with the web and delivery. It took about a year. He hired a bunch of his friends who had MBAs and a research chef and a real estate guy, and they came up with this thing they called the Oasis Virtual Supercenter. Said, we don't need any real estate. We can do it all over the web. We can do delivery. Customers can come to our site. We can deliver their goods after they choose it in a 15-minute window, somewhere between 2 and 6 hours after they place the order. Boy, was he smoking crack. In February of the next year, VP of Engineering was hired. It was the first of any engineering effort that was hired. This was all just marketing requirements documents, deep process diagrams, subsystems from a business standpoint. By the time I got there in May, there was about a foot of marketing requirements documents that described the flow of the entire system from a business standpoint, had no clue about how to do it from an engineering standpoint. But hey, this was the web. This was the dot-com bubble. We could do anything, and we didn't have to know how to do it because we were going to do it better than anyone else had. So one team went off. We were hiring people. One team went off and designed the DC. Out of one person, he hired, very smart hire, hired somebody who had been designing distribution centers for grocery stores for 20 years. He designed our DC. That's why it worked as well as it did. Didn't work very well, but that's why it worked as well as it did. I didn't know anything about transportation logistics, but hey, I was now the expert. So I started going off and finding people and talking to logistics companies and routing scheduling companies who thought I was absolutely crazy to talk about making a 30-minute window anywhere. There were a few companies that we talked to that were willing to deal with me at all after the first phone call. And only one of them that didn't have a standalone routing application where there was a person who was uploading the day's orders onto a PC and looking at it graphically and looking at the schedule, but actually they were willing to license me a DLL that I could bind into an application of my own. Christmas that year, the DC was done enough that we could go and have our Christmas party there. The ambient chain was done. The cold room wasn't done yet. We made our first delivery a year after I got hired. We launched in a couple months after that to the entire Bay Area. Huge mistake. Somewhere along the way, we had raised $250 million. That was the video that I showed at the end of the break was part of the pitch. So that got us $250 million. We hired a CFO whose job was get us to the IPO. That's all his job was. And he did. We raised $400 million in the IPO. In February, less than a year after launching, we'd ramped to 3,000 orders a day. We had four releases between 1.0 and 2.0. In 2.0, part of the cost of the money was a land grab. We were supposed to be in 29 markets in 3 years. Each DC, we'll talk about this a little more, each DC cost $30 million to build. Had about nine to 12 month lead time. So we opened Atlanta second, mostly because it was ready. It was about the sixth market down in desirability. 2.0 wasn't working in the Bay Area very well, but we cloned it to Atlanta. We cloned it to Chicago, too, because we had to. We bought Home Grocery, who was our top competitor, at a deal that was marked at something like a $1 billion deal. And then we closed the doors. So, I said I'm not going to talk about the business too much. Basic idea was 30-minute delivery, hard goods, last mile for hard goods. We started out by doing grocery delivery because that got us into the door. That got us into a trust relationship with customers. It got us in the neighborhoods. But the real concept or conceit, depending on how you want to look at it, was that we would be delivering the things that you ordered on the web so you wouldn't have to pay FedEx $10 to $15 for every package. That was really the goal. Everybody thought we were crazy to make 30-minute windows. We made 30-minute windows 95% of the time. That was the easy part. We spent $1 million a day for 1,000 days, and then we closed the doors.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. As I said, happier time. So these are the numbers for the DC in the Bay Area. Basically, we serve 60-mile area, 330,000 square feet, cost $30 million to build. We stocked it with 50,000 SKUs. It was 107,000 locations. 4.5 miles of conveyors, three temperature zones. We had frozen ice cream because that was a design goal to get hard ice cream would be delivered hard to our farthest customers. We didn't do frozen turkeys because you couldn't fit them in a tote. So we did fresh turkeys as a non-conveyable. We broke the area up into 14 zones, so each zone had a cross dock. We did at least four vans in each zone. The thing that was supposed to make this work and to compete with groceries was that we didn't need to have grocery stores in high-value real estate locations. We could put our cross docks in lower rent areas. And the difference in price would make up for the delivery. Yeah, maybe. The target was 8,000 orders a day. The DC was designed for 10,000 orders a day. So we thought we had lots of headroom. Break-even was 4,000 per day. And the average target for the order was $100 an order. What does it say here? So I was coached to get my point across first. So this is the first of the lessons learned slide. Customers don't know where they live. We spent a lot of money to get very high-quality maps and the highest quality geocoder that was available at the time. We had 25% geocoding error when we expected 3%. Why? Customers type street instead of avenue. They give us the wrong zip code. They can't spell their street name. And we didn't have any mechanism for online feedback when they registered. So if you go to Google Maps now and you type in an address, it doesn't know exactly. It asks you, is this where you want? Is this the string you meant? It shows you the map location. 28.8 modem, we couldn't do that. Maps didn't know where they lived either. This wasn't too bad in the Bay Area. When we went to Atlanta, we discovered that Atlanta was building new houses faster than the post office could keep up. And the mapping vendor certainly couldn't keep up. Map vendor will typically revisit an area every 3 to 4 quarters if it's really busy, 6 to 8 quarters if it's not. It was just a disaster, and we had to develop a bunch of heuristics for letting the CSRs enter the lat long of a customer directly so we could get them there. We hired couriers for their customer service skills, not for their driving skills. This was really good because they were our customer-facing employees. It was really bad because half of them couldn't read maps. So we thought that we would have the same courier driving the same region and that, you know, he'd just figure it out from the list of addresses. And the reality was that we had to give him turn-by-turn directions just to get him there on time. Letting the customer dictate your schedule is a really bad idea. I'll show you in a second how customers pick their delivery window. We didn't know what we were doing at first, so we just let them pick them. We just said, you know, there's a spot, and we'll put it in the schedule, and there's another spot, we'll put it in the schedule. And we got these really crazy routes because we had, and the couriers complained, you know, and the transportation guys complained, you know, you're supposed to be making these beautiful routes that are circles and loops and so on and so forth. And I said, well, you can't do that because we let the customers pick where they want us to go and when. So we had to learn a lot about that. And we didn't know how to measure it. We'd get all these stories about, well, I went to the site and I looked at such and such, and I go, let's see, delivery window if you've never seen one. This is what you were presented with when you want to schedule. It was custom for each user, so it was based on your address, what vans we thought could reach you at what windows. So I went there, so someone would say, I went there and I didn't see anything, and then I saw someone come by, or I came back later, or so on and so forth. We didn't have a clue how to go back and measure those things, because it was different for everybody who visited. So I actually ended up logging every state transition for the delivery schedule so I could recreate anybody's schedule at any time very painfully. So knowing what to measure and knowing how to measure van efficiency was very difficult for us, and it wasn't until we hired some industrial engineers who had worked for FedEx who understood the problem and understood how to build metrics to determine the problem that we started getting a handle on this. Big picture. It was a moderately complicated architecture. I'll show you a couple diagrams. I'll just flash past a couple diagrams. Basically, there were three subsystems that were meant to intermediate between the different pieces of order fulfillment, ERP, and the customers. The customer website was supposed to work without the back-end systems being up. At one point, we thought that there would be one front-end for all the 29 fulfillment systems. That didn't work out so well. This is the first level view. I worked on this. Route planners, MFT2 backends, and XPS services. That was all the transportation stuff we thought. But it affected everything, and I'll talk about that a lot. This is a slightly more realistic view of what the system looked like when you add everything in. You know, there's a lot of cross crap in here. As I said, I could go on for a long time. We talked about making a promise with the customer. We talked about the web store intermediating between a promise, a contract between the customer and the system. It's actually MBAs. God love them. So these are the five things that we had to do to manage a promise. We had to see if there was inventory. We had to see if there was inventory when the customer had chosen their delivery slot, which meant that we really encouraged people to pick their delivery slot first. They didn't have to. So sometimes you would go through and you'd shop and you'd come to the end and you'd pick a delivery slot. So you pick the delivery slot and half the items in your cart weren't going to be in stock then. That really pissed customers off. So we really encouraged them to pick their delivery slot first. Is there a van driver time slot? Is there van capacity? Is there truck capacity? So we ran trucks from the DC to the cross docks. And is there DC capacity? We used truck capacity as a proxy for DC capacity. We figured if we could put it on a truck, we could fill it in the DC. Didn't turn out to be true. Van capacity we measured in totes, and we understood that the vans were partitioned for chilled versus not chilled. The routing package took care of that. Van driver time slot, we dealt with that in a bunch of interesting ways. And inventory was, there was this system available to promise, an advance available to promise, and the ERP system talked to the web store, and inventory was updated every hour, and there were things that we always knew were available, and it's a really interesting business. I mean, it's standard supply chain stuff, but it's really complicated. I was amazed at how really complicated this is.
Actually, over on your left.
Yeah.
So I'm confused.
Okay.
So, I mean, I maybe this is just my the late in the day part, but every time somebody says it's wonderful how really complicated things are, my alarm bells go off in my head. And you know, the great thing about whether it's FedEx or maybe Zipcar, because Zipcar is newer, was those were really simple ideas.
Right.
They
exactly
were
right.
Incredibly simple.
Exactly
like,
right.
Fly everything through Memphis.
Right.
And so complexity, I'm really trying to understand why investors would buy complexity. We're going to try the most impossible problem.
Because the grocery market was $400 billion, and we thought we could get a piece of it. And famously, someone said to Lewis at one of the investor meetings, I think this is going to be a $1 billion business. And Lewis said, no, it's either going to be a $10 billion business or zero. So one of the problems, which you're right, one of the second slide lessons learned is the DC was much too complicated. I didn't even talk about the DC yet. Everybody who was doing delivery scheduling was doing some kind of delivery scheduling along these lines. The web store reliability, I don't know what people do today for web store reliability. I think they just have a lot of really redundant servers, and sometimes you get things wrong. Back to this. So delivery flow. I can't go through all of this. We spent a bunch of time with GIS folks trying to figure out where we should place our cross docks and how we should partition customers. We would geocode the address on the way in. Subzones were the way we managed open and closed hours. Customer would schedule a delivery. We'd confirm their order at cutoff, which was around midnight for the first zone. The orders would drop to the DC. We'd do fill the order. All of our meat, you may have seen pictures, meat, fish, produce, seafood, was handpicked to order, custom label for each customer. If you wanted inch and a half steaks, you got to say you had inch and a half steaks, and we cut inch and a half steaks for you. Customers love this. It took an hour and a half before we could to fulfill all those orders, which meant we couldn't induct totes for an extra hour and a half because the orders had to be ready before the totes got inducted. We'd start picking all the other stuff. We'd stack it on the dollies. We'd load it on the truck. While the trucks were driving, so we absorbed the stem time and most of the freeway traffic in the big trucks. And we did that sort of in the middle of the day. In the morning, we had a lot of extra time. Couriers were waiting for the trucks to arrive. They would download the routes into these ugly handheld Telzon units, ruggedized DOS boxes, had a touch screen, had a radio that we couldn't use because CDP wasn't reliable enough. We wanted to do We wanted to do returns at the door and processing credit. So it was a key marketing design feature. Okay, don't have wireless communication. Had to download the entire customer history into the handheld. So when couriers scanned for the return, we knew how much the customer paid for it. Customer prices change. We want to credit the right amount, not whether they paid for it on sale or not on sale. So it's just load the van, go off and do the delivery, handle the couriers often ended up unpacking stuff, which added time to the service time, process returns, come back and deal with the returns. So routing was easy, I said that earlier.
Chris?
Yes.
Over here on your right. Why do you suppose Fresh Direct has managed to pull this off? I mean, it's a very similar model, isn't it?
It's exactly the same. Well, it's exactly the model we started out with. Fresh Direct is succeeding because they stuck to that model. They did two things differently. They stuck with high quality rather than trying to be a Safeway replacement, which is what we shifted to. And when we opened in the entire Bay Area. 60-mile radius, 14 zones. We didn't have enough trucks. We gave everybody open hours for the whole thing. We were stretched to the limit. Fresh Direct serves 5 zip codes now, 4 of them are in Manhattan. They have density built in. We struggled to build density. This was the thing that we never got to. None of this matters. Yes, it does. Scheduling is really hard. We ended up doing all this resource scheduling that we thought was just going to be fixed. And it turned out to be pieces that we hadn't thought of, didn't know how often we would have to change them to manage the resources in the system. So we spent a lot of time doing this by hand. The one key thing is that customers could schedule their delivery up to 7 days in advance, which meant that we had van resources tied up 7 days in advance. Our personnel was scheduled 7 days in advance. So if we saw a surge in a zone, we couldn't do anything about it because we couldn't say, oh, you know, we're going to take that truck and we're going to put it over there. We never figured out how to do that. We made some really bad choices, it turns out, about van and truck size versus shift length. Driver brakes turned into a problem after they drive for 8 hours, blah, blah, blah. We learned a lot about what the airlines call yield management. It's differential pricing. We didn't do much with differential pricing. They play a lot of games to get you in your seat and charge you as much as they can for it. So we tried making the maps smarter. I have a lot of frustrations with the maps. The second part of my talk is going to be about making the maps smarter, too. We ran into special events. Even though we didn't put the vans on the freeway, we would run into effects from ball games, concerts, parades, so on and so forth. We ended up building a system that got overlaid on top of the routing system that we had, calendar-based system. An area manager could go in and say, there's going to be this kind of problem in this zone these times. We'd slow the traffic down. Really gross, but it worked great. Same thing for construction. Speeds were an issue. If you go to Google or Yahoo and you ask for a drive time, you're going to get a drive time estimate that's based on the speed limit. The system I used allowed me to put in somewhat more varied speeds, but they were all just a guess. They had nothing to do with reality other than the cluster load. We tried a little bit of variable pricing for delivery slots.
Was there, back to
the... I'm sorry. Back. Yes?
Was there any kind of learning, statistical or otherwise, that you did to adjust to make those more and more realistic automatically?
The speeds? No.
Yes.
No, that's it. Okay. But I'll talk about that in a minute, though.
Chris?
Yeah.
So, airlines went to yield management because the margins got thinner.
Right.
Right. Okay. You went to yield management before you had any margins. You had negative margins.
That's correct.
The CEO should have been fired for operating a business that only worked when its margins were so thin. I mean, what $600 million bond issue was issued for WebVan in this time frame? $600 million of senior capital. I mean, whoever is not in jail for this operation should be thrown in jail. I mean, technology can keep you out of jail. You know, Jesus.
So as an apology, I'll say we got forced by the VCs to keep opening markets, and so we didn't ever have time to go back and fix it. Also, we were forced by ourselves. We opened everywhere, and we couldn't take stuff away once we'd given it to the customer. One of the things that we did was we started closing areas, but we'd sneak a few hours away here and sneak a few hours away there. It made our van scheduling problem a lot harder because we were now moving things around, but we actually were able to build some density into the market. So we played games with shortening window, keeping the window short, but reducing the amount of choice the customers had. And we did that both by the way we estimated and what circles we showed them, as well as by opening and closing hours. And ultimately, we got rid of the fill to order. The custom cut meats went away. We lost about 10% of our customers because of that, because they really liked it. They hadn't been able to get steaks that good at their local grocer for years, and they were excited that they got it from Webvan. And we paid them for it. Yes?
Did you ever ask your customers if they cared about that scheduled delivery, how important in the list of things that was to them?
Yes. We asked them, everybody. So we acquired Home Grocer. Home Grocer had been using 90-minute windows. After I left about 6 months before the company closed down. They went to a 60-minute window. We lost 50% of our customers. It's a very fickle business. So this is the, okay. What went wrong? I'll put this up here and I'll continue to answer your question. It's a very fickle business. If people are going to the grocery store anyway, why should they bother with us? That was one of our biggest things. We never got same-day delivery going, even though we planned on it and we promised on it. We had so much trouble in the DC, and we had so little delivery capacity that we couldn't offer delivery windows to someone who looked in the refrigerator in the morning and decided they needed milk so that they could have it that evening. So they were going to the grocery store anyway. Why should they bother with us? My family bothered with them because it was really convenient, and the produce was better than any I could get anywhere else. Our produce was touched 3 times, where Safeway's is touched 11 times. But we were in the minority, very clearly. We needed 5 deliveries per hour. It took about 10 minutes to do a delivery, plus parking and drive time. We didn't reliably get to 4 per hour, except in a couple of zones.
Chris, how important was the unpacking to the customers? How important was the feature that the customer service reps would unpack?
To the ones who got used to it, it was very important. They complained when the courier showed up, dropped the totes, started showing up, dropping the totes and leaving. To the ones who were more recent customers, they didn't care. Because the totes were probably going to stay there anyway. We didn't charge enough for the totes either, by the way. There are lots of Webvan totes still going around. $3 a piece, they weren't a deal.
Chris, just right in front of you, there are a bunch of services around now that are supermarket chain affiliated, notably Peapod. I don't know if they're thriving, but they're certainly surviving over many years. Would that have been an important differentiator for your success to be hooked up with somebody who knew the business already?
So we thought Peapod was crazy. Peapod's been around for almost 20 years. They started as a fax-in service with personal shoppers who went to Safeway or whatever the local chain was and did your shopping for you off of a limited list. But they're just getting the quality of stuff at Safeway, and we started as Carriage Trade. We were going to get you Kobe beef, same-day delivery, high-quality cigars, champagne, Opus One wine. Just craziness. So after we opened, Peapod went to an own store model. They almost went out of business. Ahold bought them and continues. I don't know what they're using as a fulfillment model now, but they're not doing very well. Albertsons picked up delivery service, started a delivery service after we went out of business, and they've given it up. They were doing fulfillment out of the store. They were marking it as an advertising cost that was hidden in each manager's P&L rather than breaking out separately. So nobody really knows how they did, but they've given it up. The UK is doing better. Tesco does home delivery. Ocado is pure play doing home delivery. They have density built in. Density is king. You've got to be able to spend more time delivering than you're spending driving. That's what FedEx does. They drive an average, I think, of 1 to 2 minutes to the next stop. We sometimes spend 10 minutes driving to the next stop. That's a whole delivery that we missed. It was really hard to get customers to plan ahead. Nobody almost nobody liked that, even though we came up with all kinds of aids to make it easier to keep track of what you're going to need, what you needed last time, and so on. It was really hard to shift demand in time. Everybody wanted their deliveries between 7 and 9 in the morning and 4 and 7 at night. We were running two shifts couriers. We had to pay them. We did some initiatives with offices. We found a lot of office managers were ordering all their Cokes and their and party platters and so on from us. And so we tried to take advantage of that, but it came at different kind of sales that we never really managed. Okay, more lessons. Don't design for perfection. The entire system was designed believing that it would work. Oh, wait, I missed one. The DC. The DC never worked. The DC was designed for 10,000 orders a day. We're sure we could do 8,000. Every time we got over 3,200, it melted down. Every order was held up by 2 hours. We pissed off a whole bunch of customers that way. We would build up customers. Customers repeatedly went through the pattern of, I'll try you, it's great. I'll try you, it's great. Oh, this is wonderful. I'm going to order the goods for my dinner party for 20 people this Friday. And from you, I'm going to have it delivered at 5 o'clock because then it's fresh and ready. And we didn't show up. Or we showed up without the steaks. These were people in, you know, Atherton and up the hill and who were beginning to put together $300 orders, and we lost them. You can only do that so many times before you run out of people that you can piss off. I think I've said pretty much all of this. Too much technology. It's just entirely too much technology. We had, so we acquired Home Grocer. Home Grocer had a much smaller DC model, and we had actually started designing a DC model that was much smaller, simpler, didn't have these crazy flippers and conveyors and so on. It was sort of a half automated, half hand pick model that would have been much better, certainly a lot cheaper and easier to open. Density.
You know, it looks like one lesson you're leaving out, which is don't breathe your own fumes. I mean, and this was a common lesson.
Right.
You know, there were so many reality distortion fields that got set up during that period.
Absolutely right.
And then, thank God you got a Ferrari out of the deal.
Oh, I had the Ferrari beforehand. That was my inheritance. I spent my inheritance on part of that, or part of my inheritance on that. So.
Sorry, what did you mean by think big in the right places?
What do I mean by think big in the right places? We didn't think about optimizing the entire transportation chain. We thought the pieces of it were going to be really easy. So we ended up building a number of add-on tools to try and patch it together rather than thinking about that at the beginning. That was actually the hard part. The fulfillment was the easy part, relatively speaking. Could have been easier and certainly could have been a much simpler model. Lewis was in love with this idea of running dry cleaning racks around for ambient goods, and that's what we did. So we made a bunch of the wrong trade-offs, and we never had the opportunity to recover.
But it sounds like the biggest mistake you made was not having any time to learn.
Yes.
This design cycle, no time to iterate.
That's absolutely right. We got one design, and then everything else was sort of incremental. We never even had the opportunity to go and do a second system. God help us. This is what I really want to talk about. Making the math smarter, I said. One of my frustrations at the time, and continues today, is everybody knows that you don't drive down 101 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because you're going to hit the backup in Mountain View. If you look at a map that you buy from Navtech, you can spend as much money as you want, it's going to tell you, it's a great road. Class 1 road, freeway, you should be able to drive 55 miles an hour down there. I don't have a site here, but Texas A&M traffic study, rush hour traffic's 39%, on average 39% slower across the United States. It's obvious. I said it before, if you go to Google Maps or Yahoo, you're going to see this kind of travel time. The reality is this. This is data that I pulled off, Illinois DOT site. So there are a bunch of people who are doing traffic products now. You can get it on your cell phone. There are half a dozen websites that will offer you real-time traffic information. They show you pretty much these. They show you the outliers. That's kind of interesting if you want to be entertained. If you're trying to plan deliveries, what you want is this. want something that's going to approximate that blue line. Show you on the roadmap, in your map, by time of day, day of week, how fast can you be expected to go with, you know, 75-80% confidence, something better than the speed limit. So how might you get this data? There are loop sensors in a lot of the freeways. They're unreliable. They're just an engineering disaster. Most of them are single loops, so they're based on an average vehicle length. So whether a truck goes over or a car goes over it, they get one count and they say, oh, it's an average vehicle length, so we must be going about this fast. They tend to break. People are putting up tag readers for your RFID, Easy Pass, Fast Track, whatever tag readers. They're starting to use those. There's a company called Speed Info that's put together some side-scan radar that they're selling to the DOTs. They're selling the data to the DOTs. People are trying to do cell phone triangulation for tracking. Works okay for the freeways. If you are willing to constrain the problem, you can sort of constrain what the triangulation result is. Doesn't really work for arterials. Doesn't really work for the streets in your neighborhood. Track vehicles. So there are about 500,000, maybe 600,000 now vehicles in the United States that have GPS trackers in them and that are tracked on a 1 to 15 minute basis because they're commercial vehicles. They have a contract with some automated vehicle logistics vendor. And that data is available. You know, somebody's looking to see if Joe took an extra break or, you know, did he make it on time, so on. So that's something where you can actually do something with history. So full disclosure, I've been working with a company called Landsonar, the one on the left, to solve exactly this problem. The CEO came to me and said, you work on this stuff at WebVan. I have this crazy idea. And I said, yeah, it's kind of a cool idea. Here's what I think you should do. And so I talked to them from time to time. They have a bunch of GPS data. They've built a simple predictive model that works surprisingly well. And they have some deals. There are a bunch of other people in the market who are doing what I call entertainment value traffic. Maybe not INRIX. INRIX is making a lot of noise. It's not clear what they're going to ship. TrafficCast is doing stuff from the freeways. But they're selling to Yahoo and Google at this point. If you go to Google and you get flow data on your cell phone, you're getting their data. The only person who's only company making money in this space is Westwood One. Westwood One is they own radio slots and billboards. They have 29 traffic centers in the United States where they have little people, producers and video cameras, and they run a couple helicopters. And they have if you hear Metro Traffic Control or Metro Traffic Central on your radio, it's a Westwood One employee. Westwood One barters those slots for advertising and then sells the advertising. And they actually, it's purely entertainment and they know it. If you're stuck in your car and you want to know why there's traffic jam, that's great. So they get incident information. It's all about real time. They're interested, though, in trying to figure out how to turn this traffic data into something that they can sell and something that people can predict with. And I already talked about the state DOTs.
Chris?
Yes.
Right in front of me.
Yes.
Which of these services, the in-car GPS units, like the ones that Acura has?
Acura is from Navtech. So Navtech is, they sell GPS units. They built their own traffic system. They get their data from traffic.com, from the state DOTs, and from their own collection. So it's a real mishmash of data sources and reporting styles and how you get it into the map versus layering it on top of the map. And that is my last slide. And what I really want to leave you with is that this is coming. In some sense, the people will start being able to do a better job of predicting traffic and predicting traffic for planning. And I think that it's important to look at the difference between planning your traffic, planning your trip, especially for a large ERP kind of planning, even but for personal planning, if you're going somewhere that you aren't familiar with or if you're going someplace at a different time than you're familiar with, there's a bunch of interesting information that's being collected now. And I think some of the other talks that we had today were about interesting information that's being collected now. And it's not going to be too long before this gets repurposed into something that you can use rather than just something where you have to worry about Big Brother. Questions? Goodness. What have I done?
So, who are the VCs who funded this? Again, and is this story, I mean, this is just a nice, probably one of the peak stories on the whole web or,
They funded WebVan or they funded?
Yeah, WebVan, yeah.
WebVan was SoftBank, and SoftBank was one of the biggest ones. Sorry, I don't remember anymore.
Yeah, and is the whole story somewhere? Because you've got chapters.
There's a really nice HBS case study. I have a copy of it, maybe even in my bag with me. They did a nice job of looking at the business model, and I'll look and see who the VCs were. It's in there. None of the principals have been willing to talk to anybody. Everybody who was in early still feels really burned. But it's like John Perry said, we breathed our own vapors. We believed that this was going to be a great thing, and it really hurts that it didn't work out. Yeah, Dave?
Yeah, so I had just a quick comment for Gordon and other people. The chairman of the Anderson Consulting or whatever was Shaheen was brought in as the CEO in the peak of this period and helped raise all the money. So you may know him. The interesting thing about this latter traffic data stuff is one wonders, the police have an interest in traffic speeds and flows. Lots of people do. And it's clearly valuable. Right? So why is this, and presumably I see cameras all over the place. You could take it from cameras if nothing else. Why is this data not being aggregated and like weather, the weather, National Weather Service is viewed as a public service. Why not make it available to even to private folks from those sensors to repurpose and publish and make money?
So the state, as
NWS does.
Right. The state DOT data is, at least it varies a little by state, but mostly it's publicly available. It's publicly funded data that is available on a website somewhere. They collect it mostly for planning purposes, and they have noticed that they could repurpose it for flow. But they're not very interested. They have no reason to try and sell it. So they don't. And so it's freely available, and that's why everybody has it. And that's, the 15% coverage that was on that chart. The cameras are, for the most part, the cameras that you see these days are, for the most part, traffic light controls. They're using image processing to do to turn stoplights on and off rather than quadrature loops in the pavement for all the reasons that I mentioned, that loops are bad things. So in the UK, they use, they have a lot of speed cameras, obviously. They also use, I think the congestion tax system is based on TV cameras. They do imaging of license plates and recognition. That's how they bill you. And they've also built a system that does flow data based on that. They look for a license plate that's here on the motorway, and they compute the average time. So there are a bunch of technologies, and there is not yet a compelling mechanism for distributing it. So there are a number of companies that are trying to make use of it.
Is there a standard in that industry, like something? Okay. There's no public XML-based standard that's evolved at this point to say, I want data about such and so, and vendors could offer.
The nice thing about standards is there are so many to choose from. Every DOT has come up with their own. Some of them are XML-based. Some of them are just CSVs. There's a company who makes a business of managing sensors for DOTs, and they publish, they have, I think, six of the state DOTs now, and they publish all of their data in the same format. That's as close as there is to a standard right now.
The pre-conference meeting was a lovely report about all of this.
Yes.
The conclusion was the only groups that can make a success out of this are those with bricks and mortar based systems, the Albertsons, which you said is now stepped back.
Right.
What about the others?
I don't believe that. But who am I? You know, I don't. So here's the thing. The thing that I don't like about the bricks and mortar guys is that the quality is never good. The quality gets an extra touch or two out of the bricks and mortar, after their store. And I already don't shop there because I don't like the quality of their produce, or I don't like their product mix. One of the things I didn't mention is that product mix was a real problem for us. Two anecdotes. One is, if you buy your Coke in six packs of 12-ounce cans, there's an 80% chance that you will not take it in any other format. So somebody who wants to sell this has to sell 6s, 12s, 24s, 2-liter bottles of Coke. That's eight positions in the warehouse where we thought we might get away with one. The other thing is that we have 50,000 SKUs. Average grocery store has around 17,000. We thought, oh, this is great. We can offer a lot of stuff. Well, every grocery store has about 10,000 of those SKUs are the same. The other 7,000 are custom to the neighborhood. You just can't compete. One of the things that we discovered, Bay Area's got a very diverse ethnic mix. What we discovered was we had a very white bread population. And when we tried, even though we were delivering to all of the, we had delivery hours in all the other areas that were doing poorly for us. How do we fix that? Oh, product mix is wrong. We didn't offer any Indian food, for example. So we tried offering Indian food, and it's like, okay, well, what SKUs are we going to throw out? And that's when we discovered this. So there's this huge brand awareness marketing issue around this. And that might be the reason that bricks and mortar stores can do well. But I don't think their focus is on doing delivery. And so it's going to be it's a very different mix. I have much more confidence in the Fresh Direct model of doing a very good job at a very limited market, and I let a thousand flowers bloom. I don't think it's ever going to scale up the way we thought it would.
Chris?
Yes?
Slightly derived here. Amazon is just making a big push into the non-perishable UPS-delivered grocery.
We think that's funny.
Yes.
It's a webman guy who's running that.
And you don't expect it to succeed.
So there's a company called NetDirect. They came onto the market about in 1997. They were doing that. They were shipping dry goods by FedEx. They're still around. Shipping dry goods by FedEx is great. Not having to lug the 50-pound bag of dog food to your home is great. Not having to pull the 24-pack of Coke on your motorcycle is great if someone's willing to pay for it. And, are you willing to pay for it, or is Amazon willing to pay for it? Apparently Webvan was willing to pay for it. So.
All right. Well, Chris, sorry it didn't work out, but yeah. Glad you're still here to tell the tale.
Thanks. So I found a bunch of Webvan commercials in the process of putting this talk together. They're all on Google Video, and a couple of them are on or will be on the website. I highly recommend that you look at the one entitled Nectarade. That's the best one of the bunch.
Okay, thanks for joining us. All right.